I'm Amber Hunt, and this is Accused, the unsolved murder of Elizabeth Andes. On the last episode,
my dad came up to me and he said, "Sue," he said, "they think it was Bob." And I just remember going, "No," like that, and just like hit my dad's chest, like totally freaked out.
If she had lived and we had stayed in contact, and we were both free, that I think we might have gone out and something might have transpired.
Two days after Bob Young's murder trial began in Butler County, Ohio, his defense lawyer got a typewritten letter in the mail. It was dated March 16, 1979, and postmarked in Dayton, Ohio, about 45 miles from Oxford. It read, quote, "Sir, you must get Bob freed. He did not harm E. Andes. I did it about a half hour before the time estimated he got there. $40 was not much, but I needed a fix badly. Now I'm very sorry," end quote. Deb Lydon, the lawyer who's working on the case for free, calls this the addict letter.
Personally, I think that letter could be of extreme significance in this case.
The note was sent to Matthew Crehan, Bob's defense lawyer at the time, who forwarded it to police. It was dusted them for fingerprints, and in recent years, it's been tested for DNA residue. Lydon says, in fact, that this letter has been so thoroughly analyzed that it's actually been destroyed in the process. Nothing useful has been gleaned. It's one of the many mysteries in this case. This episode, I want to look at how police handled the initial investigation 37 years ago, and at the trial that followed just 3 months later. I'll also address what's been done in years since, and I'll tell you straight out that not everyone has liked my line of questioning into this case.
You're spending your hair and playing coquettish and getting nothing.
This is Richard Walter, who's regarded as a world-renowned profiling expert. He works with an organization called VDOC, which is this cool conglomeration of experts across all kinds of disciplines. They meet once a month in Philadelphia to hear presentations on cold cases, and they were kind enough to listen to Oxford Lieutenant Jeff Robinson's take on Beth's case in 2014. I can't tell you how excited I was to talk with Walter, nor how confused I was when the chat took a turn.
Yeah, the answer is not to attack the police on that issue. The answer, from a strategy point of view, for Christ's sake, is put so much pressure on them, not by criticism, but by saying, given the current view of the evidence, okay, why the hell doesn't it go to grand jury?
The interview was supposed to be about hypotheticals, as in, what kind of culprit do the experts think is likely to have committed this horrible, seemingly rage-filled act? I've done enough reporting to know that when someone is stabbed 20 times after being strangled, it's usually classified as overkill, and experts typically don't assign overkills to strangers or robbers caught in the act. My chat with Walter took a turn when I questioned just how thorough police had been on this case and whether VDOC could even trust a presentation put together by that agency. He called me two things I've never been called before, a silly woman and coquettish. I'll get back to that later. First, let's revisit 1978. Bob Young, Beth's boyfriend, was arrested the day after her death. He was held a few days in jail before his lawyer, that's Matt Crehan, argued successfully to get him released on a $50,000 bond as he awaited trial. Crehan is a defense lawyer straight out of central casting. He believes fervently in the system, and he talks with such passion that it was one of his talks to a Miami University class shortly after this trial that pushed the inquirer's lawyer, Jack Greiner, to finish law school. If you ever meet Jack, ask him the story. It's a good one. Crehan graduated in 1958 from Manhattan College in New York City. Then he served as a captain in the Marines. He joined the FBI as a special agent in 1964. 7 years later, he got his law degree. By the time Bob Young's parents reached out to Crehan, he was known in Oxford as a big city lawyer. That reputation did not earn him much favor with Butler County officials. Crehan remembers the first time he met Bob at the Butler County Jail.
Like, it was almost catatonic. He was, very, he was still in shock. That's the best way I would describe it. He was not really communicative because he was didn't quite know why he was there and what he was doing or anything else. He was in a state of I'd say shock.
Before Bob's case, Crehan had never successfully defended someone who had confessed to police. In fact, he wasn't very open to the idea of a false confession at all.
And I have to be honest, I had a tough time getting my arms around this, with my background, being in the FBI and also, Bob was a college graduate and a football player. How he could be intimidated into giving a confession when he didn't do it was tough for me, something going on around. And it remained with me, and that's why we did a lot of work in having to prove that the confession was a false confession.
The case was high pressure and high profile. Crehan was set to face off in the courtroom with the county prosecutor himself, John Holcomb, and Michael Moser, the prosecuting attorney. He handled many of Butler County's highest profile cases. Crehan and Moser had squared off before. The year before Beth's murder, they were on opposite sides of a double murder trial. Moser had charged 36-year-old Rosalia Bounds with two counts of aggravated murder and the shooting deaths of her husband and another woman. Crehan's defense of the woman was that she'd been victimized her entire marriage. In the end, Crehan won. Bounds was convicted, but of the lesser charge of voluntary manslaughter. She was released just 2 years after the trial. Crehan and Moser were also pitted against each other that year in a contentious political battle between county commissioners and the county clerk. That fight made regular headlines in the Enquirer, with the two lawyers taking jabs at each other in the press. Normally, this is where I would love to introduce Moser, but I can't. I have repeatedly emailed, called, and even shown up at his office, but he will not respond to my many requests for comment.
Albert County Prosecutor's Office, Troy, can I help you?
Yeah, hi, I'm trying to reach Mr. Moser.
Okay, he is not in today. What, can I take a message, or is he expecting your call? Or
for transparency's sake, I will spell out that while I don't personally have a history with a prosecutor to explain his aversion to me, the Enquirer, as an institution, has fought with him in the courtroom several times. In one recent case, the Enquirer fought to get access to a 911 phone call related to a 2012 murder. The newspaper won, and Moser fought it to the state Supreme Court, which not only ruled the tape was public, but it also ordered him to pay our legal fees. I don't know if that plays a role in his decision to dodge me, and I do think dodge is fair here. Usually, elected officials who don't want to comment at least call me to say no comment. Anyway, I'd love to hear his take on this case, but it doesn't seem like that's going to happen. Holcomb died while still county prosecutor in 2000 at age 62. He had been a controversial figurehead in Butler. A few months before his death, the Enquirer ran a story in which several people who worked with him called him a bully and a brute, and said that, quote, "foes cross him at their peril," end quote. Some likened him to a diamondback rattlesnake poised to strike. In that story, Judge Rob Lyons was said to have found Holcomb so vindictive that he'd asked that anyone else in the county other than Holcomb be allowed to represent him on county business, which should have been part of Holcomb's job. I wondered if Lyons' opinion had softened over the years. He told me,
John Holcomb was a very intimidating figure. I mean, he was. I mean, his actions, his everything, he was intimidating. I don't think anybody could disagree with that.
Crehan remembers Moser and Holcomb both as excellent trial lawyers, though he also remembers feeling confident in his case.
The best trial attorneys can't come above the facts, and we had the facts. I don't care how good you are in terms of giving anecdotes and various techniques of trying to convince jurors, you can't come above the facts. And they had no facts. The only fact that they had was the statements. That was it. 130-something exhibits, only one exhibit incriminated Bob. Now, I'm not saying it was a small one. Okay? It's a big one.
It is big. Huge, actually. We've talked about the existence of this confession, but we haven't spelled out the details yet. So here they are. The statement starts off innocuously enough with Bob describing Beth's last phone call to him. That prompts his drive from Fairborn to Oxford. No one disputes the first lines of the statement, right up until he describes walking into the dark apartment. That's when issues arise. The type statement says that when Bob walked into Beth's bedroom, she was lying on the bed, nude from the waist down, and very much alive. He lay down beside her and they started to kiss. It seems a pretty specific scene he's setting. But when he took the stand at his trial, Bob said his words had been twisted. He said that Lieutenant Richard Carpenter, a Hamilton polygrapher, had asked Bob what he would have done if he'd seen Beth alive on her bed when he got into her room. "Well, I would have kissed her," Bob said he replied. According to Bob, Carpenter ran with this. "So you walked into the room and you kissed her, and then what happened?" Bob at first would correct him, he said. "No, that's not what happened. That's what would have happened." But eventually, Bob said he gave up.
The interview with Carpenter was... I mean, he definitely had an agenda. He wasn't letting me out of there until I confessed to it. And I firmly believe that. So...
That type of characterization stings those who knew Carpenter as a God-fearing and loyal law enforcement agent. Here's former colleague Frank Smith talking about him.
And when you take a look at him, he was an old-time street cop from the 60s. Very small in stature. I mean, he was about 5'6", probably 100 pounds, 110 pounds. But very much black and white. There was no in-between. And a very, very honorable man, very religious man, very honorable.
Bob says Carpenter told him he failed the polygraph miserably, which is why the lieutenant was sure Bob wasn't telling him everything. I can't ask Carpenter for his take on things. He died in 2014. He'd been a respected member of the Hamilton Police Department until his retirement years ago. What I can say is that in April 1972, 6 years before Beth Andes was killed, Carpenter was quoted in an Enquirer story about polygraphers. In it, he said that he feels a criminal polygraph test isn't really successful unless the suspect cops out by confessing. A polygraph is really an amazing tool. In the 1970s, it was this new mind-blowing technology that, while not admitted often in court, was relied upon heavily in interrogations. There's a misconception that they're not reliable enough for court. Here's forensic polygrapher Nate Gordon. He's the director of Philadelphia-based Academy for Scientific Training, and he's also part of the VDOC Society.
It's entered into about half the states on stipulation, where both sides agree ahead of time that a polygraph will be done and can be entered.
I've taken a polygraph for a story involving false confessions back in 2000. I wrote then that the machine was just as good as my mom at catching me in a lie, which is to say it nailed me. The machine works by measuring and recording the physiological responses you have as you're asked a series of questions from a polygrapher. Your blood pressure, pulse, breathing, and skin conductivity are all measured. And a trained polygrapher can supposedly detect signs of deception based on the reactions. But there's a reason they're not wholesale admitted into court. They are definitely controversial. Today, they're mostly used to help investigators sort out which avenues to pursue and which to ditch.
So they might not be able to introduce the polygraph itself, but it'll help them focus the investigation. And many times, you'll get confessions where there's really no evidence.
But we've learned since the 1970s that when you give a polygraph is crucial. I was reading a book about serial killer Dennis Rader for an upcoming episode When I learned that the husband of one of his victims in Wichita was long considered a suspect in her death because he failed two polygraphs given to him soon after he found his dead wife. According to the book written by Wichita Eagle reporters, quote, in years to come, Wichita detectives would determine that a lie detector test should never be given to a spouse or close family member immediately after a murder. If a husband has just lost his wife, his emotions might falsely register as guilt, end quote. There was another point that sounded familiar. Some Wichita detectives believed fervently for the next two decades that the man probably killed his wife. Townspeople believed it. School kids taunted the man's children that their daddy killed mommy. It was accepted as truth until Dennis Rader confessed and trophies of his many kills were found inside his home. The results of Bob Young's polygraph and Beth's murder case could have been reanalyzed by an expert today, which might shed some light on what Carpenter saw, but police say those test results have been misplaced. All we know is that Bob was told he failed, and as the hours dragged on, his statements to police grew increasingly incriminating, with Bob allegedly speaking in hypotheticals and Carpenter transcribing it as fact. Bob and Beth started talking about their impending separation, him going to Texas and her staying in Cincinnati, and Beth said she wanted him to stay with her, maybe get his master's degree. The statement signed by Bob reads, quote, I said I did not want to do that. I wanted to go out on my own for a while. Beth kind of got upset and I got angry at her. I grabbed her and threw her around a little bit, end quote. Beth got angry too and started defending herself according to the statement. Bob then says, quote, I grabbed her around the neck and squeezed her a little. She just kind of fell down on the bed. I said something to her. I said, Beth, and she didn't move. I then kind of realized that I hurt her real bad or killed her, end quote. The statement describes Bob going to the closet to get a toolbox from which he pulled a pair of scissors. He began stabbing her with them. He said he didn't know why. Quote, at the time I was stabbing her, I was still mad. And then I put a dark-colored scarf around her neck. I think I tied up her arms next. I think I used hose, end quote. These details about the crime cannot be understated. Because they're incorrect, they might have saved Bob's skin. The ligature around Beth's neck wasn't a dark-colored scarf. It was a sash from her robe. And her hands weren't tied with hose. It was a braided material, like a bootlace. On top of that, Beth had no defensive wounds, so experts testified it appeared she'd been tied up straight away in the attack, not as an afterthought. People who knew Beth can't envision her placidly allowing Bob to squeeze the life out of her. She would have fought if her hands were free. I explained these discrepancies to Saul Kassin, a distinguished professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. He's an expert in social psychology with experience in false confession cases. He said there's usually a reason a confession contains factual mistakes.
Yeah, you know why that happened? Because the first thing you described about this case is that he called it in at 9:30 p.m. and by 10 p.m. he was being interrogated.
Yes.
That where you see what you just described, a confession that doesn't match the crime scene. So the confession was factually incorrect. You see that in cases where the police run in, identify a suspect, and interrogate him into confession before they've even analyzed the crime scene. So the police don't really even know what the facts are at the point at which they're interrogating him. So they take a confession that turns out to be all wrong. And you see that in cases where they rush in and interrogate a suspect before analyzing the crime scene.
Granted, Kassin has the benefit of hindsight. To hear how people felt at the time, I tracked down Scott Heron, a former reporter whose name I'd noticed on some of the Hamilton Journal news stories from the time. He lives in Colorado now, and despite me contacting him completely out of the blue, he remembered this case and his opinion about it from the time.
I thought he should walk. The reason I did is that the time frame didn't make sense, and I think that's how he got off.
Yeah.
That's presented by the prosecution.
it just didn't make, there wasn't the time to do it that the prosecution said to do, you know, that to get where, he might have come from Fairborn, or I forget where he was from.
It's a good memory. It was Fairborn.
Yeah, and so there were details on the calls of when a call started and when he got there, and how it, and there just wasn't enough time. It just didn't seem possible to do it in that amount of time.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
If you're like me and refuse to let go of your skinny jeans, you're a millennial. And if you're a millennial, it's time to add Clarins Multi-Active Cream to your daily routine. Rooted in nature and innovated with science, Clarins has a long legacy of creating industry-first, plant-forward products. Using a skin charger complex made of 2% niacinamide and sea holly bioextract, Clarins Multi-Active Cream has been clinically proven to target the first visible signs of aging by smoothing lines and wrinkles, refining pores, evening tone and texture, and strengthening the skin's moisture barrier. While Multi-Active Cream can't bring back the golden age of boy bands, it can de-stress your skin. Clarins Multi-Active Cream is available online now. Go to clarins.com/truecrime and get Multi-Active Day and Night Cream for 10% off, a free welcome gift, plus free shipping on your first order. That's clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME. clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME.
In most criminal cases, defendants are advised not to take the stand. It's a constitutional right that if you're charged with a crime, you don't have to defend yourself before a jury, and the risk usually outweighs the potential benefit. In this case, however, Crehan was all for Bob testifying. He figured his client needed to undo the damage that his signed statement might do before the jury. And Bob held up well under cross-examination. We don't have audio from the trial, but we do have 1,000 pages of transcripts. You can sense the tension in certain passages, like when Holcomb seemed to find it odd that Bob chose to shower before he drove from Fairborn to Oxford. Holcomb, let me ask you this. If you were going to work that night, why did you take a shower before you went? Bob, because I'd sat around all day and hadn't taken one. Holcomb, isn't it a fact that you never had any intention of doing work that night? Isn't it a fact that your only intention was to work the next day? Bob, no, we probably would have done some work that night. Holcomb, didn't you tell the Oxford chief you were going to do work the next day? Anyway, Bob was unflappable. No, he said, we probably would have shampooed the carpet. And he said he probably would have helped Beth pack, maybe take down some plants. There's another part in which Holcomb seemed to take issue with Bob, saying that he removed his glasses when he entered the apartment because they had fogged up from the walk outside. Holcomb says, quote, in that 30 yards, you're telling this jury your glasses got fogged up, end quote. This seems an odd point of contention to me. I've worn glasses before. They can get fogged up in 3 yards, much less 30. I'm not sure where he was going with this. Here's me talking to Bob about the trial.
Did anything happen in the trial that surprised you? Testimony that you weren't expecting, or...
The police officers that told them that I got there at 9 o'clock, which was never said, because I couldn't have got there leaving at 8 at 9 o'clock. But he testified to that. The one thing that Holcomb said about, you know, my extra bag of clothes, and he made a big point and yelled out that, where's your other pair of socks? Thought that was bizarre. Like I used my socks to clean up or something. I don't know.
Do you remember why you only had one pair of socks?
Just didn't pack any. I can wear one pair for a while if I have to.
Because you're a college boy.
Yeah. I could wear them a week.
Yeah.
Okay. Holcomb also grilled Bob about the supposed motive for murder. It's true, isn't it, Mr. Young, that you wanted to be out on your own? Isn't it true that it was your idea to split? Isn't it true that she didn't want you to go to Texas? Bob's answers read as calm. Maybe she would have liked for me to stay, but she wasn't upset I was going out there for a while. Nothing was definite. On redirect, Crehan asked his client point blank, could you have killed Beth Andes? Bob said no. Quote, I loved her more than any person I've ever met in my life. There's no way, no way, end quote. The jury agreed, no way. Rich McCauley, who had been friends with both Beth and Bob, was in the courtroom when the verdict came.
It was a full packed courtroom. Of course, there was a lot of tension, emotion in the courtroom on both sides. You know, one, it's, and there was a lot, there was, I think it was all of the Miami people were there, most of them. One, looking for what happened to Beth, who's responsible, and two, here's one of our very good friends that is on trial for it. So you could just imagine the tension going on, once again, from both sides, because the Andy's looking, okay, who did this? It came back innocent, and the place erupted. Absolutely erupted of all this pent-up anxiety, tension, I don't know if it was energy, I don't know what kind of energy, but just it exploded. And I vividly remember Mr. Andy standing up and saying, then who killed my daughter? Vividly remember that.
I asked Crehan and his then partner, Jack Erickson, about the not guilty verdict. They said there was a total sense of relief. Their bodies just went limp, but they certainly weren't celebrating.
Yeah, the way I felt like, I think I even said something to Bob is, look, there's no winners here.
Yeah. Yeah.
This family lost their daughter.
Yeah.
You're, no matter what, people are going to think you killed somebody. There's no winners here. And you can't, how can you be elated when these people who sit there that lost their child?
Right, you just can't.
After the jury acquitted him, Bob thought the legal ordeal was over, but he was wrong. Beth's family still believed he must have done it, so the next year, they filed the wrongful death suit. That went to trial 3 years later, and in 1983, Crehan convinced another jury that Bob Young was innocent of Beth's murder. One of the most gut-wrenching aspects of this case is trying to see it from the perspective of Beth's parents. Scott Heron, the former reporter, remembers talking to Charles Andes after the first trial.
The father was understandably upset, and he was a, if I recall, retired military, maybe Marine. And I remember him telling me, I talked to him on the phone, even if he didn't do it, he was mad at him for having confessed. That throws the whole thing away, so the real killer got away.
Right.
So he was mad at him either way. Obviously, if he killed his daughter, he'd be mad. But even if he didn't kill his daughter, he was. And I thought that was an interesting idea, and I understood, and it made sense how the father felt that way.
I asked Bob about this.
How have you come to terms with knowing that they believed that you did it?
I don't know if that's something you come to terms with, but, for the longest time, we went back through and did this again in a civil trial the next year, and they were, adamant that I was responsible. And, you know, all these years that I thought they were, I've always, you know, wanted to do something to prove to them that it wasn't me, but really didn't know, without having a lot of money to just throw at it, what to do. So I'm hoping this may help.
Bob says he's worked to forgive himself for the confession.
Do you blame yourself that it, because the statement might have made it so that they zeroed in on you?
Oh, yeah, sure. But I blame myself more for just not being there. I mean, that's, I could have been there easily. You know, that's the thing that I have gone, you know, round and round all the time. But yeah, if I hadn't have done that, said, you know, did sign the confession, they would have been forced to continue on to do something. They would have still tried me, but they would have at least had to find some evidence, you know. So sure, yeah.
That brings me back to the VIDOC Society. That's a group named after a French investigator spelled V-I-D-O-C-Q. It has prestigious members from all kinds of investigative disciplines, polygraphers, inspector generals, forensic pathologists, retired FBI agents, experts in every crime-solving field imaginable. They gather to hear presentations on cold cases over a monthly luncheon, and then they brainstorm directions for police to pursue. I envision it as something like a Stitch and Bitch with a Sherlock Holmes twist. The organization was featured in a 2010 best-selling book called The Murder Room by Michael Capuzzo. Lieutenant Robinson took Beth's case to them 2 years ago after the pro bono lawyer Leiden asked Bob Young to sign an affidavit modifying that sealing order we discussed in the first episode. Robinson says he spent 650 work hours on the case before his VDOC presentation. He didn't re-interview players in the case, but he did re-examine crime scene photographs and he sent fingerprints through the updated federal databases. Remember, because Butler County's lawyers deemed the files off-limits for 30-plus years, he was the first fresh set of eyes from law enforcement on the case in decades. He had to start everything from scratch. And Oxford is a small police department, so he was juggling plenty of other duties while tackling this one. Robinson's presentation mentioned three people who knew Beth, at least peripherally, who perhaps had been more deserving of deeper questioning back in 1978. In truth, there are more than three possibilities, of course. There's also the possibility that it could have been, oh, anyone in Oxford on the correct date. Random crime is rare, but it happens. Think Ted Bundy and John Wayne Gacy. That's the frustrating part about not knowing precisely what kind of puzzle we're working with here. The three Robinson was most interested in were the maintenance man, who'd been accused of leaving Beth's door unlocked, the boss, who spent a few hours at Beth's apartment the night before she died, and most prominently, a man who supposedly had never met Beth but knew Bob, and who behaved bizarrely after he learned of the crime. This latter character reportedly confessed a crush on Bob as he inserted himself into the investigation. In fact, he'd shown up at Bob's parents' house just days after the arrest. I should note that none of these people are new to investigators. Each was referenced in a pretrial letter from Matt Crehan to prosecutors in 1979, weeks before the trial began. Crehan even mentioned in that letter that police might want to look at R.J. Villela, that friend of Beth's we spoke to, the one who had a crush on her. Crehan said R.J. maybe hit on Beth over Christmas break, and Beth rejected him, a scene R.J. denied to me. Villela didn't concern Robinson much, but the other three were each part of his presentation to VDOC. Robinson said he walked away from this VDOC meeting with new perspective.
Interesting aspect of this case, and that's the psychological profile of the person that did this. And a lot of what I think some of the professional criminologists and criminalists in this have said is, this isn't somebody trying to cover up a crime. This wasn't somebody trying to cover up a theft or a bad report to a manager. That there's a reason that this was committed, and there's a certain personality type that's behind this. And that's some of the information we got from the VDOC that I think has been very beneficial. I think it's helped narrow our focus as to the type of person we're looking for. It gives us some answers as far as, are we on the right track or are we not on the right track?
If you struggle to get in shape and lose weight, I'm about to change your life. I'm Carl, the CEO of Body, and I don't like working out and eating healthy either. So here's how I get myself to do it. I make myself own the morning. And by the morning, I mean the first hour or so every day. It's not family time. It's not for scrolling social media. It's for my results and my health. And man, does it work. Every day, I get out of bed, drink a health shake I made the night before, and then I go crush a workout in the Body app and just follow along day by day. Before most people are even out of bed, I'm done for the day. So here's my offer to you. If you sign up for a one-year subscription to Body, I'll give you 65% off. 65%! Because I want you to start now and see how fast the pounds come off and the muscles start popping. And if they don't, hey, you get your money back. But the sale ends this week, so don't wait. Sign up for a year of Body and save 65%. Just go to body.com. That's BODI.com. And let's own the morning together and get healthy and fit.
I flew to Pennsylvania to interview a couple of VDOC officials in person. They were happy to walk me through their general process, but they declined to talk about Beth's case specifically. They like to leave the nitty-gritty of individual cases up to the law enforcement agencies that are investigating them. But VDOC members Nate Gordon and Benjamin Redman were comfortable talking about how false confessions come about.
False confessions generally occur with prolonged interrogations. I would say interrogations that have gone more than 3 hours are more likely to wind up with a false confession.
That's polygrapher Nate Gordon speaking.
Because if one of the things that happens with this suspect is they have this fear that, how do I get out of this? And if they have this belief that, okay, if I just say I did it, even though I know I didn't, and I know they can't prove it because I didn't do it, I can get out of here. So I'll write whatever they want. And that leads to a false confession, obviously, which might be the only evidence that gets them convicted. So their hope that just by signing this piece of paper and get them out and there's nothing they can do to them because they're innocent anyway, they won't be able to prove it, doesn't work for them.
He mentioned that interrogators especially need to be cautious interviewing, quote, feeble-minded people, end quote. And that resonated with me because in each false confession case I'd covered before this one, the supposed confessor had either been an impressionable kid or someone with a low IQ. Joseph Statham, the Oxford police chief in 78, had told me that this is one of the reasons he never believed Bob could have falsely confessed. Statham said Bob was a smart guy, a college graduate, while Richard Carpenter had dropped out of high school in the 10th grade. When I asked Nate Gordon about this, he said,
"Oh yeah, anybody can confess to something they didn't do. Not because of their being biased, but because they think that no one can prove it, for example, or they have this feeling that they're separated from the world, and the only way they're going to get to see the world again is to tell the truth or to confess, even though they didn't do something. Again, with the mindset, I didn't do it, they'd never be able to prove it, this will get me out of this room, so I'll just say whatever they want to hear."
And what if the interrogator was a high school dropout while the suspect was a college grad?
I don't know what school education necessarily has with the ability of an interrogator. Just because I had a 10th grade education or just because I'm just a high school graduate doesn't mean that I'm not skilled at my art. And my art is interrogation. Just because I'm a college grad doesn't mean I'm streetwise. You know?
I've interviewed multiple experts on this, and not one of them has told me that false confessions don't happen. They do. It's an accepted phenomenon. So this is where I get a little sanctimonious. I get why they zeroed in on Bob. I get why they tried him, even. What I don't get is that they never looked at anybody else as a possible suspect after his acquittal. I talked with Gordon and Benjamin Redman about this as I tried to dance along the edge of respecting that they didn't want to talk about this specific case. Redman was a high-ranking IRS official before becoming Philadelphia's inspector general in the 90s, and eventually he became a member of the VDOC Society.
How tricky is it, though, when you're dealing with people who were involved in what seems to be the getting of a false confession? They believe that confession 37 years ago. They believe they have to believe that they got it legitimately, because otherwise they're believing that one of their colleagues.
You're talking about the
wrong
case out in your jurisdiction.
Yeah, I'm trying to do it generally, but the fact is that it's kind of a specific scenario, but I've got people who were involved in the getting of this confession who are in charge of whether this case continues to be investigated. They think they had the right guy. Isn't there a point when I don't report on certain things that are too close to me? Isn't there a point where it's appropriate to step back and let somebody else step into the investigation?
You're asking, what are you trying to put us on the spot? Yeah, sure.
No, I'm not.
I can't answer that.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't answer that.
But let's say you can be like, all right, people think I got it wrong, so just let somebody else come in. And if you're right, the next person should come to the same conclusion, right?
Yeah, but how about if you're worried that you're wrong? Because you want someone to prove you wrong?
If it meant catching a killer?
Well, that's a nice trait.
Okay.
Later, I talked to Richard Walter, another VDOC member, by phone. The profiler remembered this case specifically. He also remembered which of the three possible people of interest presented by Robinson that VDOC members thought was the most likely culprit. Walter told me, without using names, who he felt was the killer. He said that person is now dead, which fits just one of the people Robinson had discussed, the one who inserted himself into the case. If it is him, there will be no trial, no justice. But I venture that the family would still be relieved to know for certain it was him, because at least they'd have an answer. But two of the three acquaintances who interested Robinson and Lydon are still alive, still in Ohio, in fact. And they've not been interviewed by police since the week after Beth died. I've talked to both of them. That's what I was telling Walter when he called me a silly woman.
So you're playing detective then?
Yeah, I am. You know why? Because the detectives aren't. And I know how ridiculous it sounds. But when I'm the first person to call somebody who supposedly spent... I'm not saying this guy did it. I'm just saying pick up the phone, right?
Right.
For the sake of continued transparency, I'll say that I used another word between the and phone, but my editor had me delete it here so as not to offend listeners.
So it bothers me. If I had been reinvestigating this...
You're laying your expectations for what he should be doing for his own investigation, okay? That very well may be a reasonable belief on your side, but you're becoming imposing on him and telling him how he should be doing it. And in point of fact, it may, even though I may have at some point agreed with you, okay, the fact of the matter is it sloppy, yes, but it may not be relevant because of other extenuating circumstances that you don't know anything about, okay? And so it's kind of like me trying to tell you how to write a story, okay? Allegedly, you have skill that can do a good job, otherwise you wouldn't be employed, okay? But, well, that's not true. But anyway,
You're liking to get your digs in on me, huh?
I'm trying to back you up from being so self-righteous.
I doubt Walter's alone in his estimation of me on this case. I suspect he articulated some things that some others were uncomfortable saying out loud. I told him I just wanted to understand why he, as an expert, thought the man was the culprit. I said it would bother me to publish that about a man who's not around to defend himself without at least explaining the why behind it.
I don't want to go... No, but I don't want to go to print with just somebody saying so. Like, that's the part that I would have trouble sleeping at night.
Don't even say. You could say that, A, the case was... tried, convicted, exonerated, and or whatever. And from that, then, there are results, but why haven't we heard anything about it? Rather than trying to get in and trying to explain it all. You're not qualified to explain it.
Maybe I am being coquettish on a couple of points. I haven't told you yet who precisely we're talking about, for example. I also teased last episode that you would hear more from the maintenance man. It's coming, I promise. ¶¶ next time on Accused.
Well, it is my alibi. I was at the movie with Steve Green, but maybe it was a later show.
Do I need to worry about you too?
This is a special project from the Cincinnati Enquirer, narrated by Amber Hunt, produced by Amanda Rossman, edited by Amy Wilson, and engineered by Stephen Baum at Cincinnati Public Radio. Music was composed by Andrew Higley. To look at case documents, photos, videos, and more, visit cincinnati.com/accused podcast.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.